Vectis Radio on DAB.
Welcome to Maggie Talks To, a series of in-depth conversations with people who live and work here on the Isle of Wight. I'm here with Huxley, the magician, and many other things. How are you, Huxley?
I'm very well, thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So can I ask you, were you born here on the island?
I like to say I'm an honorary Corkhead.
All right.
I moved over when I was about, I think I must be about 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And so where I've done all my sort of schooling here, and where the island is it can be big, it can be small, depending on the sort of angle you look at.
Right.
And when I used to work at festivals up and down the country, people sort of say, oh, do you know John?
Chances are,
probably won't know John, because there's 140,000 people that live on this island sometimes.
And a lot of them are called John.
That's it. And then it turns out that if you dig a little bit deeper, I might not know John, but I'll probably know John's friends, and I'm probably friends with him on Facebook. So yeah, that's how small the island is.
Yeah. So where did you go to school?
Cowes High School. Well, it's Solent Middle School back in the day, which is now the Gurren and Garnard primary site. And then from there, I went up to, Cowes High School with Mr. Avery, who reminded me of Harold Bishop from Neighbours at the time.
Oh, right. And did you like school?
I'm an interesting character when it comes to school, because I definitely excelled in areas that I was really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But like many kids, you get those school reports that say, he's good, but he's got so much potential, and if he pointed it in the right direction.
Yeah.
There was areas which I excelled in, and I even think I got a star in some mock exams, but the majority of my stuff was all sort of B's and C's and stuff. It was sort of like just underneath perfect.
But did you enjoy it all?
Yes and no. Schooling's like, it's an interesting experience that majority of us go through. And I say that because I've worked with and do work with and some of my family, my cousins and stuff, are homeschooled. And we've got a massive homeschool network on the island. I think it can be quite a contrast against somebody's schooling days, as you were, sort of the social interactions, the even just the general rules of walking around the school and stuff like that. Are there things that almost set you up for compliance for modern day life? Maybe easier in some respects.
Yeah.
But then the homeschoolers can really focus on like youth-led stuff. So I might have excelled better if I was homeschooled in certain areas, but then maybe I would have failed in others.
You just don't know, do you?
Everyone's experience is totally different, and I think that it's just about how you look at it.
Yeah.
It can be a testing experience for a lot of kids going through all that time. But also with schooling, you're built up to remember so much stuff. And my long-term memory is sometimes not that good. So to spend sort of 2 or 3 years like revising, and then you're thrown like 10, 11 sets of exams all in one hit, at a time where you're going through puberty and everything's crazy, and you're interested in like members of the other sex, and it's a wild time, and it's a lot of pressure to be putting on adolescents. And now someone that's the other side of that, I can't believe that we put our kids through that kind of pressure.
And you left school at 16?
I did my schooling, did all right in my GCSEs, and then I took that into the sixth form. So I was really chuffed about getting into the sixth form, focusing and studying on areas that I'd selected and picked. At the time, it was photography, PE, and it was photography, it was like a sports science PE.
Right, yeah.
And there was one other subject, but I forget what it was. It might have just been science generally. And then in the second year, I ended up changing from the sports science stuff to CDT, design, craft design technology. And it just gave the ability for me to access tools to make things.
Yeah.
I was forever going down into the tech labs and making things.
What things?
I think they started off with challenges in technology, I can't remember many of the things that I made, but I remember one of my friends, one of his challenges that I was helping him out with was a solar panel setup that moved and it focused on the sun. So you're getting your most amount of sunlight possible, depending on when the sun tracks across the sky, the mirror tilts and angles because of it. And so he had to build the unit and write the coding and stuff for it. I think at one time I had decided that I like computer games and racing. And if I took this old keyboard apart and then rewired all of the buttons that you'd use for controls, then I could put in a steering wheel and I started trying to build an arcade machine for a racing game. But yeah, it was, I often bite off more than I can chew. So I don't think I finished that project.
Oh dear.
But I think I remember the guy in the stores, Ken in the stores, was a bit of a legend in our school. He had some teak wood and he said it was very good, very expensive, very nice wood. And he ended up giving me the teak wood. And I made, I think, 50 pendants in about an hour and a half. And waxed them and burnt them with a soldering iron. And they were like runestone shapes and they were really nice pendants.
That's quite a hard wood, isn't it?
Very hard. And yeah. So really nice. It looked beautiful, and but I popped down to Dragonfly in Newport Town Centre and said, I've made these. And she said, oh, buy the lot. And I made my first sale as a young entrepreneur.
Wow.
And I think, yeah, that definitely had an impact upon me, realising that the things that I create could potentially be worth money. So, yeah, it was an interesting experience.
I bet, yeah. What happened after that?
You know, I did about 18 months of sixth form and then I dropped out, and I would veer any adolescent child away from that particular route. I wouldn't say that 18 months of sixth form and then not. To do 18 months of sixth form and then not do the exams, it almost wasted a year and a half sort of thing. And I should have put myself forward for it. I think at the time I was very fearful of the fact that I probably wouldn't pass, so there wasn't any point taking it. I think I got myself into that sort of groove. But at the time, I'd started working in a baguette shop or in a back end of a bar, and I'd started earning real money and stuff. So, yeah, veered away a little bit and spent a couple of summers doing some work. And then I remember there was adult education funding that was available up to people up to the age of 19. And so I narrowly just got in for the funding to be able to go to the college to study engineering.
Right.
So I thought, actually, this could be a career path. I think my parents were very excited about the fact that I'd selected a career path as opposed to be very wishy-washy about where I wanted to go. One thing happened, one thing led to another. I think there was some college disruption. There was, I think, some people left the college. I think in the 12 people that started my course towards the end, there was only me and one other guy.
Oh, right.
And so they cancelled the course and, yeah, they kind of evaporated, if you will. So I never really fully took any tests for that engineering, but I had some basic knowledge in playing around
you
with
learned
some
stuff.
Yeah, very much so. Again, it was the ability to go in and play with much bigger tools, with lathes and stuff like that. So, but I think I've always been very fascinated about processes. And if I can hold an object, majority of the time I can work out how we've created that object and the processes that have gone involved to make that thing from raw material to final product. And the series, how it's made, I'm constantly watching that. And I find that, yeah, mechanisations and processes and stuff, very fascinating. But a lot of it all comes from that initial prototype. And to see someone create and build, it fascinates me, really does.
So you like doing all these things hands-on?
Yes. Someone said to me a long time ago, you know, you can do anything that you set your mind to. And I think I might have taken that quite literally, because when I come across something that I'm quite interested in, I end up sort of deep diving. I go down a very deep rabbit hole, and I need to know the nuances about that particular subject so that I really can gauge it. Often nowadays, I'm fascinated far more with things that I don't know about. If something crops up that I just haven't come across, oh, I'm in. Because, I've usually got connected experiences from something along the lines.
Yeah.
So yeah, it just feels like a massive, everything's a network and it's all connected together. So yeah, finding those, and it's a great way to start conversations and finding that common ground, something that someone's done or experienced or seen before that you might know a little bit about.
Yeah.
And then you're away, yeah, chatting away and yeah, swapping each other's life stories.
And what happened after all that?
You're making me, there's definitely a blank gap there. I'm trying to think about that. I think the Prince's Trust, that's after doing the college stuff, there was a good couple of years again of me trying to figure out my career path or where I wanted to go. And there was an advert in the paper and it said 12-week training program for people under this age range and that, and feel free to sign up. I did, and I went to the first session, and I remember after the first session, it was a standard ice-breaking team building, meeting the other members of the team.
Yep.
And at the end of the session, I pulled the Prince's Trust team leader aside, Sue at the time, and Claire, who was running it, and said, I love this, I really appreciate it, I've enjoyed it. And they were like, yeah, because you're very good at it, and you've clearly done some of this stuff before. And I was like, I do, and that's kind of why I'm chatting with you now, because I don't know if I'm right for this course. And they were insistent, you are perfect for this course. And I was like, okay, but I've done a lot of this stuff before and I don't want to seem egotistical. I don't want to seem big-headed, but it feels like you can see in the rest of the other team members that you can see where the progression route might be.
Yes.
And they said, yeah, but the whole course is designed for whoever you are. That's your baseline. And then better yourself. So it doesn't matter where you're at, as long as you can better yourself. It's quite clear you know some stuff. So instead of just going into this as a sort of team, let's put you in there as a team, potentially team leader, so right. that we can get you to help drive this team forward. So I was like, perfect. So, all right, I'll do that. And I excelled in the 12-week course. We smashed records in the fundraising that we did. We renovated Cowes Youth Club. And I left the course and was offered a job as the Millennium Volunteers Project Coordinator.
All right.
So I'd excelled so well that they'd asked me to start running the teams. And the Prince's Trust put me through their course to become a team leader to deliver the courses. And I think I delivered 10 or 12. I was part of at least 10 or 12. I think I was the team leader for about 9 of them. But Prince's Trust's courses here on the island. When it was run by Island Volunteers through the Connections Project back in the day. So, I spent many moons as a youth project coordinator and accrediting the volunteering that people on the island did for some of their volunteering efforts and stuff. I spent about sort of, 5 or 6 years within sort of that youth industry. And it was fascinating, but I was about 22. And some of the people that were on the courses were 24. So I was teaching people older than me. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there was definitely a weird disconnect I might be too old for my age, if you will. Maybe a few more years of experience and then, yeah.
Did you get any weird comments like this young upstart teaching us?
I had dreadlocks at the time and they were big blue dreadlocks. I looked like Sideshow Bob from The Simpsons. So I was definitely a wild card. But because of that, the blue hair and he's young and he's trendy and he can talk with the kids. And I was almost the conduit between the academic elder people within sort of the organisations. The young people and the sort of the link between them. So yeah, at the time, it worked quite well, but it's a difficult industry to be in and trying to help, the youth out with the decline over the last 20 years for the funding and stuff to see youth clubs evaporate left, right and centre.
Yeah.
And the ones that are still surviving. It's really nice to still be involved with East Cowes Youth Club and a couple of the others. So,
brilliant.
So yeah. And then I ran away to the circus.
Did you? Right, we'll stop there for some adverts.
Yeah,
we'll
absolutely.
Be back in a minute.
Vectis Radio on DAB.
We're back with Huxley after those adverts. And you were doing something.
I ran away to the circus.
Yes, the circus. Any particular circus or one that was going past?
So the Bestival turned up on the Isle of Wight.
Yes.
And I think it must have been in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And I had obtained working tickets at this time. I think I was doing some bar work and stuff down there. So I was very much part of the first festival,
right,
or the Bestival. And at the bottom of a hill, there was a tea tent. And it served chai, and it was a very proper hippie-like den sort of thing that served like chai and tea. And as we went in there, I was quite fascinated by the structure, especially the little sort of almost conservatory of canvas and wood that was attached to the side of this little tea tent. And as I entered it, I instantly said, "This is a yurt." And the guy behind the counter sort of plucked his ears up and said, "What can you tell me about a yurt?" And I said, "Wow, is this crazy? I've literally just watched a documentary on Ray Mears going around somewhere in the top of Russia and Mongolia. And he was working with these Mongols, and they were showing you the sort of construction of the felt that they need to create these beautiful structures. And they have a trellis around the outside, and it's all because they don't like piercing the ground, so they don't put tent pegs in the ground. And the trellis is self-supporting, so they can actually climb on top of the roof, and the weight would disperse down through the trellis." And the guy is sat there, and he seems fascinated with what I'm telling him. And I've obviously gauged the fact that he's enjoying me chatting away. And I was like, "But this is the roof has the cartwheel, if you will. It's a giant circular thing that all of the spokes go into. And but you can't take it through the door." And he went, "Oh, right." And you see his eyes lit up. And I said, no, you can't take it through the door. It's very, very bad luck. You always have to pass it over the top. That's the way of the yurt." And he says, I've got to say, I'm very fascinated by your talk." And I said, "So where's this from? Where did you get it from?" And he said, "I made it." And it turns out he had constructed this based on almost exactly what I had been telling him. So he was very excited to find somebody else who had appreciated his handicraft work. And I said, "Well, it's fantastic." And he said, "Well, I just want to let you know, we're raffling this off at the end of this festival, and it's £2 a ticket." At which point I put my hand in my pocket and thrust all the money I had on the top. And
it was £2.
£14 for seven tickets at £2 each. And this was very late at night, maybe 1 or 2 in the morning. I had almost no recollection of this the following day. And about, I think, 6 or 7 that evening, I had a phone call to say that I'd won a giant yogurt. And I didn't know what this means, but because it was a yogurt and it was lost in like translation, I was told of a location that I had to go walk down to the bottom of the hill. You'll see us down there. And they'd been trying to get hold of me for a while for this giant yogurt.
They'd been waiting with this giant yogurt, yeah.
So brandishing spoons, me and my friends went down the hill expecting to see a giant yogurt. And a almost fanfare had, they were having a sort of end of like season festival party. And they were excited to welcome the winner of the yurt. And apparently I had won the raffle and the yurt was now mine.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And yeah, so the entire night I spent sat almost like the king of the yurt with people round coming in to congratulate me. Someone opened a bottle of champagne. I don't even drink champagne, but there was champagne, there was candlelit. I think we were there till the sun rose in the morning, having the best time. And then the logistical nightmare of trying to then de-pack it and trying to get it home in a mini metro along with all my festival stuff. So, yeah, that kind of started. It was a really beautiful experience, but it started a weird addiction to festivals. There was something very beautiful about all coming together and putting decorations and creations and music and poetry and comedy, and everyone did it for that one weekend and had a blast for that one weekend, and then it disappeared, and then it wouldn't be back for another year, and then you'd recount stories and stuff that you'd maybe seen of the weekend, some that were believable, some that were completely not believable.
Yep.
The following year I got a phone call, just literally random phone call, saying, "Hi, my name's Rob. I heard that you won a yurt last year. Is there any chance that I could borrow it for Glastonbury Festival? For the Isle of Wight Festival?" And I said, "Yeah, that shouldn't be a problem." Anyway, it turns out it was robbed the bank, and he'd asked, he'd heard about the yurt, and he wanted a little yurt to stay in with his family. So I gladly lent him it, and he'd give us a couple of tickets for that festival. So I ended up getting in free that year, which was lovely. And I tried to wangle some tickets for Glastonbury, because I'd never been, and I'd heard it was the festival of festivals. But unfortunately, there wasn't anything spare going for that particular festival. So if anything comes up, he would let me know. So there was potential. And at that particular festival that I'd got in for free, I bumped into Brenton Grant, who ran the Henna Tattoo Studio many moons ago. And I became their tea boy for the weekend, making tea for all of the artists and keeping everyone happy, making sure the line and the queue was set. And making sure people didn't smudge their tattoos when they left the tent. And at the end of that festival, they were quite impressed with my work, and they had a spare ticket for Glastonbury and asked if I wanted to come along.
No, you said.
Oh, I instantly was on the phone to my work trying to get extra annual leave to be able to accommodate it. I went across to Glastonbury, and I think from there I did 11 festivals that season. I ended up, quitting the job that I was in to effectively run away to the festival circuit.
Good for you.
And
how did you get into magic?
Well, so did the festivals for many moons, at one point, I did a festival for many seasons, and then I ended up in... Romsey is a specialist sales recruitment consultant. I only lasted about 6 to 9 months there.
Right.
I was very good at the talking part of the job.
The gift of the gab, yes.
Yeah, but the hardline sales driven targets was not something that made me very happy. It was put a lot of stress and pressure onto my world. I came back to the island, and I kind of with my tail between my legs, and I'd done a bit of things. I'd even painted, I think, on the Brighton Pier henna tattoos for about 3 months. I did a stint down there. But yeah, I was just a little bit kind of almost lost. And the island is magnetic. Many people have managed to leave this beautiful island, but then they get magnetically pulled and drawn back to it in some way, shape or form. So, I found myself coming back and obviously spending time and with family. And then I ended up getting a job. I just needed something to get by. And a restaurant job at Pizza Hut popped up. For many moons, I'd always been fascinated by things that intrigue me and things that I understand the process of. And magic's one of those things where... it's very vast. There's so many different types of magic. There's so many different mediums, so many different props, styles. And so every time I started to delve down one edge of the rabbit hole, I found another 4 or 5 sort of legs to it. And I would definitely say I'm a jack of all trades and not a master of one, because I like to know a little bit in each of the fields to be able to cover a bit of coin magic, a bit of rope magic, a bit of card magic, the stage illusions, the mentalism stuff, the kids' parties, the adult-only stuff, the versatility to me, to be able to do anything, is something that I hold paramount, and making sure that client that I work for gets the best value for money in whatever they hire me for. So, but often if they've got a vision and they're like, this is how I see it, then tell me the vision and I'll show how I can add the extra magical touches to make that vision a reality. So, I sort of fell into this role of being a waiter. But when I started the job on day one, they said, if you've got any additional skills that you can add to being a waiter, we would like to see them, because they will help you get your tips, and your tips are your own. So tips, will go into your pocket.
Good incentive.
It was a perfect incentive at the time, absolutely, because I happened to have a trick on me for some reason. I had a little dice box called Gary. He's featured in...
Why Gary?
I think most of my tools have names.
Right.
And it helps me remember.
Okay.
And I think the first time I got it out, I said, this is a dice. And I think a child says, what's his name?
Right.
And I think I said to the child, what should we call him? And they said Gary.
Right.
And I went with it.
And it stuck.
And it, I didn't look back, sort of thing. Jeff came later because somebody else with a J, not a G, the cool kind. And there's lots of there's Howard and there's Mary. There's a few different names of, but it's great for me because it's almost code word to speak about a certain prop.
Right.
And if you speak about a certain prop the wrong way, you completely reveal the trick.
Right.
So I often get people come up to me and say, can you do that trick where you pull the bowling ball out of the suitcase? And the answer is now no, because you know what's going to happen and you've just revealed what the answer is.
Yeah.
So it's going to spoil the trick in question.
Yes.
So if you say, have you got that briefcase one, wink, wink? Yeah, totally. I know where you're going. I'll do that one for you. But usually, yeah, if you reveal the crescendo, I'm less likely to do it because it spoils that element of it. So, so I fell into magic because of the restaurant stuff, the tips made for tricks, the tricks made for new tips. And then before you knew it, I had sort of mums and dads sort of thrusting sort of 50, 60 pound notes and me sort of, you know, please come and do my kids' party of the weekend and that you're brilliant. After I think 4 or 5 years of just sort of plodding along, I got my own insurance stuff. I got my own sort of business name, and then I started to take to the world and become a magician / entertainer. At the time, we had the Isle of Wight Magic Circle, which I joke is there's more like four of us on the island, so we call it a magic square. Is the sort of joke that we use. But there's about, I think at the time must have been maybe 10 sort of magician-y types, and they used to sort of meet up in Ryde. Often in a cellar of a place down the front. And there was a massive flood 1 year, and it flooded the cellar, and a lot of the paper books and a lot of the props that were stored in boxes all got destroyed.
Oh dear.
And anything that was salvaged went up the road to one of the churches. And they stored some of it there, but the majority of the sort of magic clubs and stuff sort of disbanded. But before they did disband, they had a little competition. And the 2011 Magic Championships for the Isle of Wight was won by me. I have the trophy on my mantelpiece still. So.
That Huxley the Magician, yes.
I've been milking that cow ever since.
Why wouldn't it? So you got into serious magic and entertaining. Did you get lots and lots of business? Did you get people saying, oh, he's not that good, or he's brilliant, or
I definitely take criticism to heart.
I'm sure you do.
So whenever I put my name to anything, I always try and make sure, as I say, that people are going to give me a good reputation for afterwards. So I definitely took to it, and made a good reputation here on the island, but without trying to step on too many toes because of other magicians and stuff that were here.
Yep.
But I know most of the guys in the industry, especially here on the island, and I respect a lot of the different styles and the things that they do. And it is important to know, because I don't want to repeat the same sort of things.
No.
And if Dave Randini's out there doing a certain trick, or if Aaron Eisted's or Luke Lamont, then I don't want to be copying a similar routine.
Absolutely.
But again, my style is a bit wacky and a bit crazy. And if I do find a trick that I really love, I will reimagine it to put a local twist or a Huxley twist upon it, if possible.
So did you still have the dreadlocks?
They went in, I think, 2015. It must have been around then, yeah. I started every time I drove the car, if I moved my head, they pulled on my neck and it really hurt my neck.
Oh.
And so, yeah, I used to get really stuck with neck problems, and then I was really worried about receding hairline. So, I snipped them off and had a normal haircut. So,
We're going to stop there for a moment, have some more adverts, and we'll be back in a moment.
Vectis Radio on DAB.
We're back again with Huxley. Now, what happened next?
So this is Yeah, just sort of start of my magical sort of career here, if you will, on the island. So I managed to win the Isle of Wight 2011 Magic Championships, and so with that accolade of award-winning magician, I very much took to anything and everything that I could get my hands onto that was magic. Really, I think at one point I even. Because I like designing tricks and I put in my own twist on them, I contacted everybody. And when I mean everybody, I mean everybody. I mean all of the multinational companies, yeah, Nestle, Coca-Cola, Red Bull. There was Mars, because there's different like factories and stuff on that. Obviously, these are all mainstream now. They turn a blind eye as opposed to the sort of the local sort of varieties. But I was looking for more sort of a corporate sponsorship lead. What I was asking specifically for wasn't money, it was products. Give right. me your products and let me design something around them, show you what I can do, and then use me for one of your promo experiences, utilize the trick in an advert or whatever it is. And every single company that I wrote to just went, no.
Oh.
And Jelly Belly's Jelly Beans...
right.
The lady called Victoria had read my email and apparently liked the cut of my jib, and asked me for my address, and then a huge package of boxes of jelly beans, some apparel. She'd even had some cards printed with the Jelly Beans logo on the back for me to immerse myself in the sort of creation of magic tricks. And I created an entire set of magic tricks and filmed a lot of them for a promotional video, and that's online. My friends the Ohms at the time were starting to make a name for themselves, and they had a few original songs, so because it was a great way to promote them, I asked them for their original songs to put as a soundtrack, and so that there got put onto YouTube. And it helped me. It gave me the ability. I was asked to perform in Selfridges in London to do the tricks that I'd created, which I felt was just, it was quite a beautiful accolade to be, you know, invited to our capital city to perform my magic that I'd come up with. So yeah, it was a great experience, and I did a few corporate gigs. I did a few big hotels, big galas and stuff, which was great. But as with all islanders know, those ferry prices are they're not cheap, and so getting off the island and adding the extra hour and a half per way travel, in addition to the queuing, in addition to the cost and stuff, it doesn't make it viable and profitable for me to be coming off the island at that particular time and stuff. So I was I always happy to offer those services, but often find that most of the stuff that I was doing was based here on the island. So I spent the last, I think it must be 16 years doing what I do: weddings, kids parties, adult shows, and had a few collaborative events. One with a burlesque dancer. Natalie, we've done a Miss Isabel Lamour. She's we did a show called Flux, which was a really good twist on a time machine and exotic dancing throughout the generations. And we pepper potted magic tricks with burlesque dancing. And it's one of those shows. It's a bit like the zombie show that I did with Adam Gattrell. It's one of those that, again, like my school reports, had a lot of potential, should have taken all of the way. My henna boss, Brent and Grant, I've got so much time for them, I love them to pieces. And they've seen me and seen me operate and seen me do my thing. And Brent once said to me, and it resonated very much with me, that I am a Catherine Wheel when I should be a rocket. There's a lot of sparks coming out in all directions, but if it was just focused on one thing, then we'd get a lot further. and that resonates with me a lot.
Well, it must be nice, though, to be recognised for your abilities as a magician. But you do other things as well, like fossils and...
I do dabble, yeah. So I still don't feel as though I've exhausted the end of the magic sort of rabbit hole. I've
there
still
must
got,
be always something to learn.
There really is. Yeah, I'm still not that good at coin magic. And there's a few other sort of mediums and sort of areas which are. But I still build my own tricks and utilising some of the modern technologies now. So I do that a lot. In my sort of, I guess, personal time and stuff when I'm not doing the performance stuff. And about 4 or 5 years ago, Greg and Flick, I had worked with at Haven Street for many moons, had told me that they were fascinated with whales and dolphins and they needed to go to Scotland to study them as part of this thing they were doing. But you can only do that in the summertime. But in the summertime, they're always booked up doing fossil tours down the beach for Island Gems. So would I potentially come and fill in for them? And I said, that's great, but I have no idea about dinosaurs. And they said, that's fine. We can train you up. But we know you can deal with people, and that's what we're looking for. So, yeah, they trained me up, and I started doing tours, or I think it must have been within a couple of weeks of that conversation. So, I went from, I like to say I went from sort of zero to hero in the sense of in the last 4 years, I have many a five-star reviews on TripAdvisor, and the companies that I've worked for have ended up winning awards, both for the Red Funnel Awards, for the TripAdvisor Awards, that type of thing. A cut my teeth with Island Gems and have a lot of love for their team. And then I jumped ship. I went to White Coast Fossils last year. And I am with a beautiful team who I love and adore, and they all specialise in certain areas. So Jack's our invertebrate specialist with an ammonite book out last year, and Theo obviously takes the most beautiful photographs and footage of underwater stuff, especially seagrass. And I recently saw a smooth hound shark inside its egg, attached to the bottom of a piece of seaweed,
right.
And to see it live is very beautiful. And we've got Nell and Joe, Joe comes over from the mainland, and he knows there isn't much that Joe doesn't know about the North Coast. And Nell's a lovely girl. She's also our sign interpreter. So if we have any need for that, and then Meg, she's just written the Fossil and Geology Field Guide to the Isle of Wight.
That's quite a tome.
It's a beautiful book, and I have to say I'm quite chuffed because some of my fossils are even featured in it, which is quite exciting. It is a really comprehensive book. Everyone used to go for geology for Andy Field's guide. To the island.
Yep.
I would argue this has all of that information and then some more beautiful up-to-date pictures when it comes to some of the finds that we find here on the island. Yeah, White Coast Fossils are the team that I run with, they help me promote my magical fossil adventures as well.
Oh, wow. How is that different?
To combine some of the skills that I have together made sense because Greg is an amazing magician and stuff, but he didn't go down the sort of fossil-y magic route as I understand it. I had a rumour the other day from Lyme Regis Fossil Festival that there was another fossil magician out there, which I'm yet to find out who they are, but I would love to collaborate with them. And I don't see... I think it's important to understand that there is always going to be competition.
Of course there is.
But I don't see it as I see it as healthy competition, but I see it as collaboration between other people that are doing the same things that you're doing.
Yes.
I don't see them as a threat. I see them as a friend. If I can't do the work and I'm completely booked up, I will more than happy pass work on to somebody else in the field that I trust and respect that does the same sort of thing.
Brilliant.
So it's always nice to have good working friendships with all of the other, say, magicians or fossil tour guides upon the island. We see each other at the beach every day, so we might as well be friends.
Other than sort of...
But fossils and egos have gone hand in hand. There's definitely, there's sort of the bone wars, especially with Cope and Marsh is a beautiful story. Called Dragon's Teeth. It's slightly fictional by Richard, the guy who did the Jurassic Park novels. But it's a fantastic tale of cowboys, weirdly, but dinosaurs and the arguing and the sort of the egos that goes with it. So everyone
you have
wants
to have a certain amount of ego, don't you? But not too much.
I really love it when we can all appreciate a triumph. So if you find an iguanodon's tooth and it's pristine, and it might go straight into Jurassic Jim's fossil shop, priced up at £500, which is what I saw up there last time. So they can be worth money. But I might be a bit jealous secretly because you found it, and maybe we were stood next to each other and I couldn't get there fast enough. But I still am really, as a friend of mine, I'm really chuffed that you found something amazing. And I think we should all be able to celebrate our triumphs. And if someone finds something cool, that's a triumph. Yeah, you found it. Great, it's your triumph. But yeah, so I hate the the jealousy and the weird bit that goes with the ego sort of thing. So yeah, I'm it's always nice to ask what anyone's found that week and if it's been really exciting or cool. So because we're all often finding cool things.
So what's next for you, do you think, in the future?
I haven't got an award for my ceramic work yet.
Right.
I've entered a few pieces into some art exhibitions. It's been featured in a few art exhibitions. So I specialise in dinosaur ceramics. So when I find something really cool, then I will cast it and then I'll make it out of a clay that's usually got some Isle of Wight dinosaur clay or paleosols in it. So there's 125 million years of piece of the Isle of Wight in all of my clay creations. But I have mugs and bowls and the mugs have like the ammonites effectively hidden inside the bottom foot or inside the actual mug as you're drinking it. You see it pop up as you finish your tea sort of thing. So, they're sort of quirky. And ceramics are really good medium, which I stumbled across. My father-in-law, he's a top ceramicist from Stoke-on-Trent. He deals in mosaic ceramics and doesn't particularly like the pottery wheel. Whereas I've, again, studied all of these aspects to be able to do a little bit in all of them. So I've got a few mosaics and they're build up of old bits and new bits. Stuff you find on the beach that are very local. Stuff that I've specifically made that's based on stuff from the island. So I would really love to get the recognition and the accolade for that angle.
And in your spare time?
My boys, I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I've got a beautiful partner who I love to pieces, and my world is very much spent taking them to and from nursery. Toilet training, gymnastics, trying to keep the second one from jumping off curtain rails. He's a bit... Yeah, I don't know whether anyone else has got a second child syndrome thing going on, but yes, my Teddy, my second one, is a bit crazy. Herbie is very inquisitive, which I love. And people sort of said, as a dad, you'll get bored of the why questions, but I still haven't yet. I love answering his crazy questions.
It's for why?
They're good questions. The last one was about the festival arches. When you see the arches, he said, "Oh, look at those tunnels, Dad." And I said, "Oh, I think that's an arch." He said, "What makes an arch a tunnel?" And it stumped me. It really did. And it turns out there is a logical explanation. If the depth exceeds the width of the arch, then it's a tunnel.
Right. So you had to learn something.
I did. He taught me something, which I was really chuffed about.
So that's nice. So what's next?
The world is my lobster, as they say. The constant fossil hunting buzz and the stuff that goes on. I will always be out there beach combing and teaching people how to find beautiful fossils. So there will hopefully be more. Who knows, I might have a discovery. I found something on the north coast, a talon of a bird of prey, and I'm writing my first scientific paper on it. So I'm quite excited to be putting my name on the history books for that reason.
Wow.
But until I find a jaw or a hip bone, chances are I won't have a new dinosaur named after me just yet.
Oh.
But we will never know. We might
never know. So what would you say to people, young or middle-aged or whatever, about following their dreams or doing something they think they might not be good at, but then they turn out they are?
I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I say that with a giggle in my voice. It's because, I'm middle-aged now, if you will. And I still don't, I can't quite focus on that one thing.
Yeah. So what would you advise people to do? If they've got an idea in their head, should they follow it?
100%, yeah. You need to explore any and all opportunities and avenues that could potentially help you, because that thing that you think is just something that you enjoy doing could turn into a hobby, could turn into literally a business, and that business could propel you. So, you have to sort of follow your dreams and you have to experiment and try these things. And stuff might go wrong. So cover yourself and don't throw yourself into a point where it's going to cause issues.
Yes.
If you can justify some of the time or some of the expense to try it, definitely worth putting it out there. You never know. Yeah.
And do you have a particular favourite track we can play at the end of this interview?
Oh, well, I suppose it goes kind of along with this theme, really. If I find something and I really love it, I get into it, and I get into the nuances, I get into the what, why. And recently, this week, now, last week, it was It's Raining Men, right? Okay. Now, I've got my own weird ones. It was more about the when it was released, why it was released, and it was the song and the fact that the Pride community, they use it as like an anthem. And yeah, the nuances about the song was something that I found fascinating. This week, it's the Immigrant Song.
Right.
By Led Zeppelin. For some reason, I stumbled across it and then found out that it came about from their tour in Utrecht in 1970. And they couldn't go there. There was a whole political thing. And yeah, the lyrics and the fact that it was such a change from their acoustic style set of Stairways and stuff, and then suddenly, yeah. So it was it's a really interesting track, and Immigrant has a pop culture-y, it's very apt at the moment. But yeah, I think it's an interesting song. So yeah, sit back, listen, close your eyes, and see what you think.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It's really, really interesting. Thank you very much.
If you would like to hear this or any other of the conversations again, go to the Vectis Radio webpage, vectisradio.com, and you can find it amongst the podcasts.
Vectis Radio on DAB.